Welcome to Akhotra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akhotra AI. Today we're diving deep into a landmark of American literature, Zora Neale Hurston's incredible novel, Their Eyes Were Watching God.
It really is luminous, isn't it? A powerful piece.
Absolutely. And our goal here is to unpack it for you, really get into the story, Janie Crawford's journey, the themes that make it resonate so strongly even today.
It's this amazing story about finding your voice, about self-discovery.
Exactly. It's often called a love story, but so much more. It's about Janie moving from, well, silence and being defined by others to truly owning her own life and story.
And to really grasp its impact, you need to think about when it came out in 1937, right out of the Harlem Renaissance.
But Hurston wasn't just a novelist, was she? Her background was quite different.
That's right. She was a trained anthropologist, studied under Franz Boas, a huge name in the field. And that training, that deep interest in culture and folklore, just saturates the book.
You hear it in the language, the dialogue. It feels so authentic.
It is authentic. That rich Southern Black vernacular and the storytelling traditions, she captured them because she studied them. She valued them.
But that authenticity, ironically, was also a source of major controversy at the time. You mentioned Richard Wright earlier.
Yes, big controversy. Wright, among others, heavily criticized the novel. They felt it wasn't political enough.
What do they mean by that?
Well, the dominant idea among many Black intellectuals then was that literature should be a tool for social protest, directly confronting racism and oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And Hurston writes this beautiful, inward-looking story about love, community, spirituality, language, all within a Black cultural context. Wright saw it as pandering, almost, or at least not engaging with the struggle in the way he thought it should. A distraction, maybe.
So focusing on the internal life, the relationships, the porch talk that was seen as problematic.
By some, yes. But history has, I think, vindicated Hurston. That very focus is what makes it such a profound Bildungsroman, a coming-of-age story. It's Janie's quest for her own horizon, her own understanding of life and love.
And the structure she uses is brilliant for that quest, isn't it? The frame narrative.
Oh, definitely. The book starts and ends with Janie back in her hometown, Eatonville. She's been through everything.
And the townspeople are judging her, gossiping.
Right. But she doesn't explain herself to them. She chooses one person, her friend Phoebe Watson, and tells her the whole story.
That act itself, choosing her audience, telling her own story on her own terms, that's already a sign of the self-possession she's gained.
Exactly. It frames the entire narrative as an act of reclaiming her voice.
Okay, so let's follow that narrative. It really unfolds through her relationships with three very different men. Where does Janie's story begin?
It begins with her grandmother, Nanny, and this absolutely pivotal moment under a pear tree.
The pear tree scene. It's unforgettable. Janie's 16.
Yes, and she's watching a bee pollinate a blossom. And it's this moment of profound awakening for her, sexual, spiritual. It's all intertwined.
She sees this vision of love as something natural, mutual, this ecstatic shiver.
That image becomes her ideal. It's what she measures everything against for the rest of her life, this perfect, effortless union.
But Nanny sees that same awakening and is terrified.
You know, utterly terrified. Nanny's perspective is completely shaped by her own past slavery, sexual violence, the brutal realities she faced. For her, Janie's dreaminess is just dangerous vulnerability.
She has that devastating line.
The Negro woman is demure. The world. That sums up her worldview. Protection, security, respectability, that's Nanny's goal for Janie. Love doesn't factor in.
So Nanny pushes her into the first marriage, the first cage, really, Logan Killicks.
Logan represents safety in Nanny's eyes. He's older, owns land, 60 acres, a house. He's stable.
But there's no connection, no pear tree there.
Absolutely none. He's practical, dull. He sees Janie more as help, maybe property, than a partner. The moment he talks about buying a mule so she doesn't have to haul wood or threatens to make her do it.
It's like Nanny's worst fear realized, ironically. The mule existence.
Exactly. He has no concept of her inner life, her dreams. It's security, yes, but it's crushing her spirit. She's safe, but miserable.
And then along comes Joe Starks. Quite the contrast.
Oh, a complete 180. Joe, or Jody as she calls him, he bursts onto the scene, full of ambition, charisma, big plans. He talks a big game.
He literally sweeps her off her feet, doesn't he? She leaves Logan pretty quickly for him.
She does, and it's important she's not just running from Logan. She's running towards Jody's vision. He promises her the horizon, in a way.
So they go to Eatonville, this new all-black town.
And Jody basically builds it. He buys land, becomes the storekeeper, the postmaster, the mayor. He has this big voice, this need to dominate.
And Janie becomes Mrs. Mayor Starks. Sounds like an upgrade on the surface.
On the surface, yes. Status, material comfort. But it's another kind of cage, maybe even more confining. A gilded one.
How so? What does Jody do?
He puts her on a pedestal, but as a reflection of his success, his status, she's an accessory. And crucially, he silences her.
Ah, the porch talk.
Yes. The lively, witty storytelling sessions on the store porch. The heart of the community's social life. Jody forbids her from joining in, says she's too good for it.
Isolating her while elevating her.
Precisely. And then there's her hair, her beautiful long hair.
He makes her tie it up.
Yes, because it attracts attention, because it represents her natural power, her sexuality, something he can't fully control. So he forces her to bind it, hide it. It's a symbol of his need to possess and control her spirit.
She endures this for years, right? Almost 20 years.
A long time. She swallows her words, suppresses her own thoughts and feelings, until she just can't anymore.
The breaking point, when she finally speaks back.
Yes, in public. He's been picking at her appearance, her age, and she just lets fly, attacking his vanity, his manhood, right there in the store. It's a stunning moment of verbal rebellion.
And it breaks something in him, doesn't it?
It really does seem to. He gets sick shortly after, and on his deathbed, Janie finally has her say.
That must have been incredibly difficult, but necessary.
Absolutely. She tells him the truth she's held back for 2 decades, that he never knew her, never let her be herself, just wanted something to rule over. It's brutal, but it's her truth.
So Joe dies. Janie is now a wealthy widow. What does she do?
She enjoys her freedom. For the first time, she's independent. She lets her hair down, literally and figuratively. She turns down suitors. She's just relishing being her own person, making her own choices.
And that's when Tea Cake enters the picture.
Virgible Woods. A.K.A. T-Kick. And he couldn't be more different from Logan or Jody.
How does he approach her? No talk of land or status, I imagine.
No, not at all. He wanders into the store, sees her, and invites her to play checkers.
Checkers. That's it.
That's it. It's simple, playful, equal. He's younger, poorer, full of life and music. He teaches her to fish, laughs with her, tells her stories.
He actually sees her.
Yes. He encourages her to speak, values her thoughts. He enjoys her company. It's the closest thing she's found to that pear tree dream, mutual, joyful connection.
But choosing him means giving up everything she gained through Joe, doesn't it? The status, the security in Eatonville.
It's a huge risk. She sells the store, takes her money, and follows him down to the Everglades, the muck, to work as a migrant laborer alongside him.
A massive leap of faith. What's the significance of the muck?
The muck is this fertile, vibrant, chaotic place. It's the opposite of Eatonville's rigid structure and class consciousness. Down there, people live more directly, closer to the earth. Janie works in the fields with Tea Cake, shares their life fully, becomes part of this different kind of community.
It sounds idyllic, almost. But the relationship isn't perfect, is it? It's a dark moment.
No, it's not idealized. There's poverty, jealousy. And there is a disturbing incident where Tea Cake gets jealous, takes her money, and then hits her.
That's hard to reconcile with the pear tree ideal. How does the novel handle that?
It's complex. The book doesn't excuse the violence, but Janie processes it. The community's reaction is also unsettlingly accepting, reflecting harsh realities. Janie, however, seems to weigh against the totality of the relationship, the joy, the respect, the companionship he did offer, which no one else had. She forgives him, choosing the flawed reality of their connection over the emptiness she knew before. It makes the love story more real, I think, not less.
So life on the muck is rich, real, but also precarious. And then comes the hurricane.
The literal storm. It's the climax of the novel, this immense, terrifying force of nature.
Their eyes were watching God.
Exactly. Faced with the hurricane's power, all the human concerns, the social structures, they just get stripped away. It's about survival, about facing something bigger than yourself.
And it leads to tragedy.
Deep tragedy. In the chaos of the flood, Tea Cake saves Janie from a rabid dog, but he gets bitten himself.
Oh, no. Rabies?
Yes. And the disease slowly takes hold. He becomes paranoid, delirious, jealous, violent. a terrifying shadow of the man she loves.
Leading to the final awful confrontation.
He tries to shoot her in a paranoid fit, and she's forced. She has to shoot him first. In self-defense. Killing the man who brought her the most happiness. It's heartbreaking.
And then she has to defend that action. The trial.
The ultimate test of her voice. She's on trial for murder. She faces a white jury. A mostly hostile black audience from Eatonville who've heard rumors. She has to stand up and tell her story, the whole story, the love, the illness, the final desperate act to save herself.
And she does. She uses her voice fully and finally.
She does. And she's acquitted. She claims her narrative, defines herself through her own words.
So she returns to Eatonville. How is she received?
With judgment and gossip, mostly. They see her in overalls alone, and they assume the worst. But Janie is inwardly changed.
She doesn't need their approval anymore.
Not really. The real resolution is her telling the story to Phoebe, passing on her wisdom, her experience. That's the final act of self-possession.
So looking back, what's the lasting wisdom here, the horizon metaphor you mentioned?
Right. She tells Phoebe she's been towed to horizon and back. And now, she says, she can pull in her horizon and just drape it over her shoulder. It means she's integrated all of it. The dream, the pain, the love, the loss. It's all part of her now, her self-knowledge.
It's not about achieving some perfect state, but about embracing the whole journey.
Exactly. And her understanding of love evolves, too. It's not just the pear tree anymore.
The quote about the sea.
Love is lack to see. It's a move-in thing, but still in all, it takes its shape from the shore it meets, and it's different with every shore. It's fluid, changing, defined by the people involved. Beautifully put.
Such profound maturity in that.
And her final message to Phoebe is really the core of it all. Two things everybody's got to do for themselves. They got to go to God, and they got to find out about living for themselves.
It boils down to that individual journey, that personal quest for meaning and selfhood.
You have to find your own answers, live your own life.
So ultimately, Janie's story shows us that real freedom isn't about avoiding pain or hardship, maybe. It's about having the courage to live your life and tell your own story, no matter what others think.
And Hurston's radical act was insisting that the inner life, the spiritual journey of a black woman, told in her own voice and vernacular, was absolutely worthy of epic literature. It still feels revolutionary. Mandatory closing line.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.